As most of you know, this is the weekend when Christians retell their version of the universal mythic theme of death and resurrection. And I don't need to tell you that we're living in death-dealing times. For one thing, while the world has always had its afflictions and disasters, our ecological situation is unprecedented. Never before have human beings had to wonder whether the planet that gave rise to us and to the miracle of all life can continue to support that marvel. Plus, not only is the natural world in crisis, but our cultural and political worlds are largely following suit. And especially over the last several years, many of us have felt at least some measure of worry, anger, fear, sorrow, dismay, gloom, and so forth. And just as the Easter story contains a betrayal, all of this comes from living in the midst of a massive collective betrayal. A period when many private and public sector leaders are betraying the most basic of societal, political, economic, and environmental covenants. And instead of forward-facing vision, they often offer backward-looking slogans that appeal to nostalgia, but provide no real answers to our convergent crises. And it's painfully evident from the extreme forms of divisive political and religious fundamentalism that have emerged that many people can't find any other strategy than to dig in their heels and try with all their might to stem the tides of change. Yet, when viewed not with judgment, but with empathy, this reveals the confusion and desperation many folks feel in their souls today. So much so that for folks of certain religious persuasions, a final divine intervention and judgment seems the only relief from the world's tribulations. But despite all the cultural chatter about an apocalyptic end times, it's vital to realize that what ends are dominant cultural and religious narratives and the social orders built on them. The world goes on. As T.S. Eliot affirms in part of a reading of number 685 in our gray hymnal, what we call a beginning is often the end, and to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. At certain times, it becomes strikingly clear that such endings are necessary, and ecologically and culturally, we're right there. Of course, there are many facets to this ending as beginning, but philosopher Immanuel Kant summed up the big picture well. For peace to reign on earth, humans must evolve into new beings who have learned to see the whole first. And perhaps the basic divide in many cultures right now is between those able to embrace such spiritual and cultural evolution and those bent on resisting it. And even heeding Martin Luther King's and Gandhi's counsel to hold more narrow-minded challengers in the light of love, or as Jesus reportedly put it, to love your enemies, there are few things more dispiriting for those who can see the need for change and carry visions of a more inclusive way than dealing with the incomprehension, ethical immaturity, and reactive attacks of those whose consciousness is currently fixed at a more limited level. According to the Easter narrative, 2,000 some years ago, Jesus of Nazareth learned this the hard way, and regrettably, it still applies. So if you are in some distress, it's completely understandable. Still, as with that ancient allegory, in the midst of our collective dark night of the soul, there is reason to hope. For as eminent cultural historian Thomas Berry says, the dark periods of history are the creative periods. For these are the times when new ideas, arts, and institutions can be brought into being at the most basic level. The great Sufi mystical poet Rumi put this poetically, saying that betrayal is not the end of the story. When school or mosque or tower or cathedral or temple or minaret gets torn down. Then the dervishes can begin their community. Not until faithfulness turns to betrayal and betrayal turns to trust again can any human being become part of the truth. And despite current appearances, truth is indeed rising from the tomb of the grand betrayals now being perpetrated. Because just as in prior eras, for instance, when the dominance of feudal warlords gave way to the rule of religious authorities and monarchs, and just as these were later replaced by democracy, a more just and inclusive and compassionate consciousness is gradually ascending. We have entered a new historical epoch, and all over the globe, forward-thinking people are working to right the injustices and flat-out insanities our current systems and their power-mongers are fostering. This movement has grown beyond egocentric consciousness, me, beyond ethnocentric or tribal consciousness, us, to world-centric consciousness, all of us, including all the other creatures that share this planet and the health of the overall life systems on which all of us depend. Returning to Kant, such people, you among them, have evolved into new beings who have learned to see the whole first. Beings who consider the entirety of things and are creating ways of doing things based on an ethos of sustainable thriving for the whole of our interdependent world, and are thus helping peace to reign on earth. So while at times you may feel alone in your despair or anger or the like, in fact, you are not. I'm not suggesting that traveling this higher and more inclusive road during our current cultural turmoil is easy. It's a deeply challenging and heartrending time, to say the least. The powers that be won't release their death grip easily. And in the struggle of this expanded consciousness to proliferate and thrive, a positive outcome is not inevitable. Yet the final aim of spiritual development is not some blissful flight from the world's harsh realities, but the level of consciousness, compassion, and commitment we bring to the biggest issues and conflicts of our time. That is, our most cherished values and highest aspirations only become real when we act upon them. And here it may help to remember that in working to bring a more inclusive vision into being, you will be on the healthy side of history. For from the abolitionists to the suffragettes to those who supported the civil, women's, LGBTQ+, human and environmental rights movements, those who raise their eyes to higher vistas of possibilities, who open their hearts to embrace wider circles of concern, and who then act on behalf of more inclusive and benevolent values are always justified in the end. Always. Always. And as you use, we are a part of this noble and ennobling legacy. Which brings me to why I titled this talk, The Satisfaction of Action. Because for all the simple pleasures of life, which we should certainly enjoy, our deepest satisfactions are found when we attach ourselves to a moral purpose larger than ourselves, larger than our own comforts and gratifications, and act to further it. One instance of this is clearly seen in the experiences of what's now called the greatest generation, those valiant Americans who helped secure the free world's future, for that period anyway, in World War II. And if you listen to these people relate their wartime experiences, over and over, they testify that as trying and sometimes brutal as those were, that time of struggle and sacrifice and resolute devotion to a higher cause was also when their lives had the most meaning and when they felt the most alive, even joyful. And here's the thing. The greatest generation was not great because they were constitutionally superior to those who lived before or those born after that war. They became great when they faced an immense and immediate challenge that threatened their entire collective future and rose up to meet it. Our challenge is different, but our response must be similar. To squarely face looming devastation, rise with others beyond the ordinary horizons of our lives to embrace a higher call, and act until we triumph. Now, I realize our daily lives are demanding, and time is finite. Among other things, we have to eat, sleep, work, many of us anyway, possibly care for kids and or parents, floss our taxes, file our teeth, and enjoy some downtime. I also realize everyone has different life circumstances as well as diverse interests and temperaments. But that said, we stand at an unparalleled time in both this nation's and Earth's history. So while I don't want you to contort your life unduly, I do want you to bravely envision how, as a member of this current greatest generation or generations, you might rise and stretch to help accomplish the mission. And you don't even have to be hopeful to act. Scholars Cornel West and Roberto Unger state that hope is more the consequence of action than its cause. That is, hope does not so much breed action as action breeds hope. So if you've been feeling at all hopeless, regularly taking actions, however small, will help roll away that heavy stone, first for yourself, then for others who you will probably never meet. Again, Rumi captured this poetically, and we can believe him. In the ruin of heartbreak, you find the diamond of divine passion that can resurrect the dead. Some of you have already made certain impassioned commitments. Bravo. And in just minutes, Christy Iverson will outline some opportunities that anyone can do right here today. Things that turn, as Dr. King phrased it, a Sunday kind of love into a Monday kind of action. Whether you do one or more of these or others, by committing to action, you will know the satisfaction of reweaving a world that better matches our shared yearnings for harmony, fairness, respect, mutual concern, and reverence for all life, and of being able to pass that world on to future generations. And as members of the original Greatest Generation attest, in the process, we might even find joy. The Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore, who received the 1913 Nobel Prize for Literature, affirmed this when he wrote of his own dream concerning the satisfaction of action. I slept and dreamt that life was joy. I awoke and saw that life was service. I acted, and behold, service was joy. Namaste and blessed be.